Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Johnny Tan, author of From My Mama's Kitchen, Food for the Soul, Recipes for Living. Welcome to my weekly From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio show. My guest for this morning is Leanne Thiemann. She is a Hall of Fame speaker, author, and nurse. Leanne is here to talk about the 40th anniversary of Operation Baby Live, and she and I will also be discussing her latest collaborative endeavor with Chicken Soup for the Soul, The Joy of Adoption. Good morning, Leanne. Welcome to From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. How are you doing this morning?
I'm fabulous. Thank you.
Wonderful. It is a pleasure to have you on the air with me. The Joy of Adoption is a wonderful read. I can relate to several of the stories in the book, as I, myself, is an adopted child. So congratulations for getting the book released.
Well, thank you very much. It certainly was a privilege to read all those stories and to compile them into this book.
Wonderful, wonderful. Let us start by getting to know you a little better. Please give us a quick walkthrough of your life from childhood to the present moment.
Well, that's a very interesting story that starts out rather boring. I was born in Iowa, one of eight children on an Iowa farm, which I loved, and my family is still all back in Iowa. I went to nursing school and married and had two beautiful little girls. And actually, I've been married 45 years, I'm happy to say, and still crazy about him. So that's a beautiful part of my life. But when we had two little daughters, I had always in my life wanted to adopt a child, even since I was a little girl. I had this in my head. I was going to adopt a child someday. So I was stopped at a bake sale booth in Iowa City in the early 1970s, and I saw an organization called Friends of Children of Vietnam. And they were hosting a bake sale to raise money and supplies for the war orphans. And I stopped to buy a dozen cupcakes. And I often tease that that's all I ever intended to do for the orphans of the world was buy a dozen cupcakes. But instead, I became a member. I became the chapter president. And my basement became the Iowa chapter headquarters of Friends of Children of Vietnam. And so the rest of my life story really projects a lot from there. That's what's changed my life. That's how I got into writing and to speaking. And because of my operation, because of my work with Friends of Children of Vietnam, and then getting caught up in Operation Baby Lift.
Very interesting. How did your partnership with Chicken Soup come about for this wonderful book?
Well, that's all a part of this wonderful story. When I was as a volunteer of Friends of Children of Vietnam, we raised tons of supplies, 5 tons in 3 years, to send to the orphanages in Vietnam, medical supplies and so forth. And my whole story was that they asked me then if I would be the next escort to go to Vietnam and bring 6 babies back to their adoptive homes in the United States. And between the time I agreed to go and the time I got there, President Ford had okayed Operation Baby Lift. And when I arrived in Vietnam, I was greeted with the words, "Have you heard the news? President Ford okayed Operation Baby Lift. You won't help us take out 6 babies. You'll help us take out 300. And so there was in Vietnam this naive homemaker, nurse, and mom thrown into a situation where the two-story center that normally housed just 10 little babies or so was 100 babies were lying all over the floor and on mats and on sheets, and workers stayed to care for them. And in the midst of this, my husband and I had applied for adoption of a son through this organization, and we expect him in like 2 or 3 years probably. That was part of my reason for saying yes. I knew that we wouldn't get his son for a couple of years, but I thought it would mean something to him someday to know that I'd been to Vietnam where he was born. Well, on the third day I was there, I was told, "Leanne, we have all of your paperwork in order, and we know you're expecting a child in 2 to 3 years, but with Operation Baby Lift, you can wait and we'll assign you a baby from across the desk in a couple of weeks, or you can walk into the next room and choose a son." And I walked into a room of 100 babies, and actually what I say, Mitch chose me. I walked into a room of 100 babies, and this little boy took one look at me, got down on his hands and knees, crawled into my arms, my heart, and my family, and we had a son. And that moment was as awesome as the moment of childbirth. I mean, I've done it both ways, and I know. I mean, that moment was just the same as when I birthed our daughters. And so now I had a son, and I went about my glorious life after Operation Baby Lift with my husband raising our three children. And the story, I wrote my book about it called This Must Be My Brother. And a part of that story got in Chicken Soup for the Mother's Soul. Mm-hmm. And that began my affiliation with Chicken Soup. By then, I was on fire writing stories. I wrote my own story and my own book.
Yeah.
And everywhere I went, I would hear somebody's story, and I would write it and send it to Chicken Soup.
Yeah.
And while they get thousands of stories, for some reason, they liked my writing style, and I finally learned how to write a true personal story and helped people mm-hmm. write theirs and got my stories in lots of Chicken Soup books. And mm-hmm. That's when they called and asked whether I would co-author
mm-hmm.
and Chicken Soup for the Nurse's Soul. And that was the first of my now 13 Chicken mm-hmm. Soup for the Soul books.
That's fantastic. It's a wonderful story. Coming back to Operation Baby Lift, if I recall correctly, President Johnson himself was an adopted child.
President Ford, actually.
Yeah, I'm sorry, President Ford. I'm sorry, yes. Mm-hmm.
That's correct.
President Ford
that's
was
correct.
An adopted child. Yes. Mm-hmm.
That's correct. And so he had a special place for this. And I'm not sure if everybody realizes today what a brave decision that was for him to mm-hmm. allow 3,000 Vietnamese infants to come into this country. Vietnam War was in the 70s, still was very acrimonious. People were very upset about it, very against it, and there were still protests against it. So that was very courageous of him, too. And there's never been anything like it before or since.
Right. And also, if I'm not mistaken, the first actual baby lift that was done, the plane crashed.
That's right. That's a very tragic part of it. While mm-hmm. I happened to be there, as a matter of fact, we had, as a matter of fact, Friends of Children of Vietnam, the organization I was there with, was supposed to be number one and was first on the list mm-hmm. to be a part of Operation Baby Lift. But we had broken a regulation the day before, and I can tell you about that later if you'd like, and the Vietnamese government, but the Vietnamese government was really, really annoyed with us,
mm-hmm.
and they took us off of the first place position. And as a matter of fact, they took us off the list. And mm-hmm. And when I heard that, Johnny, I was upset. I argued and I
yeah.
fought, and I remember nagging that we should get that first place position back, and it was
sure.
and it was to no avail. So instead, we loaded 20 babies into the bus to take them to the Tansanute Air Force Base to load them on an Australian airliner, because we also had a chapter in Australia. And while mm-hmm. I was at the airport loading the babies on the Australian liner, I actually stood on the runway and watched as that first plane, the one I had begged to be on,
mm-hmm.
crashed after takeoff. And half of the 400 babies and volunteers died
mm-hmm.
in that crash.
It's a very tragic story. Years have gone by, and people don't talk about it anymore. And certainly, this is not something that even, I guess, in some ways, the Vietnamese community talk about. I'm so thankful the fact that you guys did a wonderful job with it and bringing it to the forefront, because ultimately, a life is a life. And the Baby Lift effort gave a lot of parents in the United States the opportunity to have a child.
Absolutely. And I think it's really important, too, that with Operation Baby Lift, a large majority of those children, including my own son,
mm-hmm.
were Amerasian. They were half American and half Asian.
Right.
And in Vietnam at the time, children of a mixed race would never be accepted in society. They would never
Precisely.
Have a birth certificate. They would never have a legal name. Therefore, they could never have a job or be married. They were
mm-hmm.
very, very much second-class citizens.
Mm-hmm.
And as a matter of fact, there were horrific stories about what happened to white and half-white babies in
mm-hmm.
Vietnam, and
right.
Too horrible to repeat. And so we knew
mm-hmm.
we had to get as many babies out as fast as we could.
Mm-hmm.
And there were lots of agencies in the United States, such as my own. I mean, Mark and I had all of our paperwork done, and we were just waiting for a child. And so there were 1,000 people waiting
yeah.
for a child who
yeah.
just got blessed in a hurry.
Yeah, yeah. Very interesting. I know you shared a little bit about your personal life experience in terms of adopting a child during the operation. Coming back to, I guess, in today's world, what should people do if they think about adopting?
Well, I honestly do believe that adoption is a calling. I do. Mm-hmm. And I think if anybody feels that nudge and that curiosity, they absolutely need to explore it. And because I think it is a calling. And I also have a personal belief, and that is that I often say this about our own son, Mitch. I believe that when God creates a child, he creates it with a parent in mind. And I often say, I don't know why Mitch was conceived in another womb or born in another land. I know with all my heart, God created him for us to be our mm-hmm. son. And when I say this to other adoptive parents, all the heads nod. It's if you are meant to adopt a child, it will be shown to you. And I think just, exploring it, finding out the answer to all of your questions, and you'll find your way.
So true. In reading your story and others, it really brings it home for me because I'm an adopted child, and I mentioned to you earlier. And one of the things that my mom told me in my later years was the fact that I was actually the third child because she was pregnant with a son for up to 7 months, and she had a major miscarriage.
Oh, no.
And afterwards, she adopted a boy. The boy lived for a month and then passed on.
Oh, my.
When you talk about there's some sort of correlation here, certain things are meant to be. You've been to Asia, so you kind of could relate to what I'm about to tell you, that in my situation was then, so obviously my mom was heartbroken. One of a distant relative from my father's side had told my mom, don't worry, if this baby I'm carrying is a boy, he's yours. No one thought a whole lot about it, but then my adopted mom and dad went to see a sage, and the sage told my mom that, don't worry, this baby that's been carried in this womb is yours. It's meant to be yours. And he went on to mention to my mom about certain features that I would have. Those came out to be true when I was born.
Wow. What a great story.
Yeah,
I wish I would have had your story in this book.
And
what
amazing.
Country was that, Donnie? What country was your ancestry?
Malaysia.
Malaysia?
Yeah, uh-huh. We are Chinese Malaysian. If you look at the palm of your hand, we have this sort of, the lifeline, the crease that goes right across the palm of your hand. You know what
right.
I'm talking about? Okay.
I do,
so
yes.
My adopted father has it on his right hand, and I have it on the left hand.
Interesting.
And I'm left-handed. I'm a southpaw.
Okay.
It was very interesting. The story that she told me was fascinating because back then in Malaysia, like Vietnam and so forth, they are just developing and all that kind of stuff and so forth. So you never even think about leaving more than 10 miles, 15 miles away from where you live.
Right.
Not to mention that because my parents grew up during the war, and the sage told her that this boy will bring you luck and that there will come a point in his life he has to go far away from home. The further he goes, the more successful he'll become. You have to let him go. And so when I'm just about to be 18 years old, I had the opportunity to come to the United States to pursue my college education. My father at that time was getting severely ill as well. So there was a decision needed to be made, and my mom reminded my dad, if you recall what this sage had told us, they never even thought about having their son going overseas, much less maybe 50 miles, 100 miles away from home.
Right, that was far away.
Far away. Yeah. When I came to the United States, when you look at it, Baton Rouge is about exactly halfway around the world on the other side of the globe.
Wow.
So it's quite interesting. Anyway, I didn't mean to segue all the way out.
That's fascinating. No, that's fascinating. And so did you remain in the United States after that?
Yes, this is my home now. I've been in the United States longer than I've been at home. My Malaysian mom passed away about a couple of years ago. I still have my sister back in Malaysia. Believe it or not, she has never left in the vicinity of our place because she enjoys it there.
Right.
And she was adopted from another family 6 years prior to my mom adopting me. You know life was tough back then in Asia. That's what happened in my mom's situation because she had two miscarriages. One in the very beginning, that's when they adopted my sister from another family. And then 6 years later where she wanted to have a boy. And my story came about from that standpoint.
Right. You know, as foreign and as strange as that sounds to people,
yeah.
I've been very blessed and had written 13 Chicken Soup for the Soul books, and I read about 2,000 stories per book. So I've read like tens of thousands of stories. And doing Adopted Soul, I have read more stories about families who, especially back in that time, and even families of European descent, it was not terribly unusual for a family member to conceive a child and relinquish it to another childless family member.
Right.
And as strange as that sounds to us today, your story really wasn't that remarkably different than what other people had done at the time.
What's interesting about it also, from a cultural standpoint of view, which you can certainly attest to this, in the fact that, in the Chinese culture or the Asian culture, you don't give away baby boys. You give girls away because, quote unquote, supposedly they marry out. You're not getting anything back to the family. But so out of my maternal mom, what my understanding is, I'm the 10th child, and she had boys and girls and so forth. She had given away 3 children. She gave away 2 daughters. My mom told me the 2 daughters are doing well. The ones that were given out did very well. I have never met my sisters or anything like that, but one supposedly is in England as a registered nurse, and then the other one is in Australia as a registered nurse. And then I'm, of course, here in the United States. So it's quite fascinating story from that perspective.
Very fascinating. You should write a book.
It's quite fun. It's exciting. And I talk about that. So this particular story, The Joy of Adoption, is near and dear to me in so many ways. And the stories that we're about to talk later, I can relate to the things that goes through in one's mind from a child's perspective, if nothing else.
I'm sure
from
you can. Yeah.
Let me ask you this. Should adopted children attempt to find their birth parents?
You know, that's completely up to the adopted child. I think no one should ever be falsely encouraged to do so. I think that, too, is something that is in their hearts, and sometimes they want to, and sometimes they do not. Mm-hmm. And I think that should just be respected with each child. For example, our son, Mitch, he was, according to the paperwork, quote, abandoned at birth, which was not terribly unusual in Vietnam at the time. Women who could not afford to care for their babies would bring them to orphanage centers or to churches and that kind of thing to relinquish them for other people to care for them when they could not. So Mitchell always knew he never could find his adoptive parents. And yet, and he had never had a desire to. He had one of his very first T-shirts as a baby said, "All American Boy." And that's exactly how Mitchell has always seen himself. We tried once having like a Vietnamese culture night at our house, or once we took him to a heritage camp, and he never had any interest in that. And we thought, we're not going to certainly insist on it. We had sort of a different approach that not every family does.
Sure.
And that was that my husband said, I'm German and you're French and German and he's Vietnamese and we're all in the same family and nobody's any more different than the other.
Right.
And so we treated him that way. He was just, though we celebrated his anniversary every year, we never treated him any differently. So he had no interest really. However, I've met a lot of the adoptees, many of whom I helped to bring out, and some of them have gone back to Vietnam. Some of them were told they would not be able to find their family members, but they actually went back to the orphanages where they had stayed and found pictures of themselves. Mm-hmm. And more than one child has found a family member in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And so it's really up to the individual, but they should never be forced to unless they're ready to. And it's something I think you just sort of know in your heart whether that's right for you or not.
Right. So true. Do you have any advice as to when and how to tell children they are adopted?
My advice is that they always know they are. That that was how, of course, it was very obvious in my family that Mitchell had dark hair and Asian eyes.
Yeah,
so, of course,
yeah.
He knew. And now my own daughter has, here in Colorado, has adopted two children from Mississippi.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have two very dark-skinned grandchildren, and of course they mm-hmm. are going to, they know they're adopted because they are different than everybody else in the family. But even so, my thought was is that adoption's not a secret, and it's nothing it should be something to be proud of, to be joyful about, to speak about, so that because adopting them was one of the best things that ever happened. And back when I was a kid, we used to tease each other, I'm ashamed to say, with my seven siblings. If we got mad at somebody, we'd say, oh, you're adopted, like it was an insult.
Right.
Actually, it's a blessing. And so whenever I counsel, you know, adoptive parents, somebody told me when she got her first baby, adopted a Caucasian baby into a Caucasian family that otherwise wouldn't have been so obvious. But as she rocked her baby, she would say, I thank you, God, for this adopted baby. I love you, my adopted baby. And her baby book was the adopted baby book. So your whole life, you just knew that you were the lucky one, that you were the lucky one.
Mm-hmm. Very true. I'm coming from the perspective of my experience with my mom, because one of the things that she was afraid to tell me was the fact that she was afraid that I would run off and try to find my real mom. I like to think that all families, when the child's growing up, you have disciplines. If you love the child, you definitely obviously have a certain amount of discipline that you do with the child to bring the child up properly and so forth, right? So
sure,
the parents are
sure.
always afraid the fact that, uh-oh, my gosh, I mean, if he finds out that or she finds out that they are adopted and maybe like you were talking about, somebody else might be feeling the fact that, well, the reason you were treated this way is because you were adopted. You're not the real child, so to speak. If you've been a real child, you've been allowed to do da-da-da-da-da-da. So one minds think about things. The uniqueness about in my mom and my situation was it came to a shock to me when I first found out. My sister was in a different situation because I guess she was adopted when she was a little bit older. So her birth certificate did show her original name in this case. And for me, I was adopted at birth, so I never had that in there. I mean, to me, this is who I am. This is the identity I have with the family.
Right.
But having found out about it, it did shook me because I was in my early teens, in my tween years, I guess, if you want to call it that way. The first thing you think about is that, well, what happened here? Are you not wanted? Something major happened. I don't know why, but then it was just very easy for me, even though you're going through the period of time, like you say, you know, you're rebellious and whatnot and so forth. But I was able to tell my mom that, no, you're the only mom I know, and this is why I'm staying put, regardless whatever happens.
Right. And I think I really think every adoptive parent goes through that. Honestly, it's irrational to some extent because I was afraid that Mitchell's Vietnamese mother would come out as one of the boat people and come find him and try to take him away from me, which was a completely irrational fear. It happened like once after Operation Babylift, maybe. So, but I think we do claim our children. They are, like I said, it's non-negotiable. You are mine as much as a birth child. And so I think there's a little paranoia with that some parents go through. And it's the truth is, when teenagers go through their teenage rebellion and so forth, you know, it's been known, of course, that an adoptive kid would think, you know, I should have stayed in Malaysia. My other parents would have done better.
Yeah.
And so I think as part of that whole teenage finding yourself and rebelling somewhat that certainly adopted kids probably do have some of those feelings. But every teenager has some feelings around something. That's just the adoption possibility.
True. Later, when I found out about who my birth mom was, the fact that she's related to us on my father's side, so she had over the years come by from time to time as a visit, not necessarily to visit me, but as a visit from a family perspective. what's interesting is that she never acknowledged it, and so nor did I want to acknowledge, because out of respect for my mom. And my mom, I think, would have been okay, but I never did. When I say my mom here, it's obviously my adopted mom.
Right.
I only have one mom. What's interesting about it is that I could see the compassion in my maternal mom, the joy in some ways in her eyes. This is what I talk about, the unconditional motherly love, because in the end, like you were talking about, the fear that you may have about Mitch mom coming on the boat, and one of these days, well, she's well-to-do, she's made it, she's looking for Mitch. I think in the end, if you guys ever do meet, I honestly believe that you will see that beautiful unconditional love through her in saying that, thank you for taking care of my son. Thank
you,
for
Johnny,
giving him. Yeah, you know, that's
exactly
something
right.
I couldn't give. Yeah.
Because the kids, and I always call them kids,
yeah.
So they're 40 now,
yeah.
That have gone back to Vietnam.
Yeah.
that's what they saw when they met their
yeah.
when they met their birth mothers. That's what they saw is
yeah.
That joy and what a gift it was to
yeah.
them to see this child flourishing. It was a gift.
Yeah, I think in the end we're not talking about Real Housewives here and all that kind of stuff. This is the real thing. When you talk about
right.
unconditional love, you're talking about God's love. When you look at that, no mother that I've known or that I've met, of course, there are always exceptions to the rules, would not want their child to succeed in life.
That's right.
It doesn't
exactly.
matter where they live, whether it's in America or even right now in Afghanistan or Syria for that matter. So
right.
that is
That's
a common
right.
bond that all mothers have that I think sometimes people don't realize that.
That's a very good point. I mean, it's as innate in when people say that we are like mother lions, for women and mothers, it is a chemical, it's a brain thing
yeah.
that we absolutely will ferociously defend
mm-hmm.
and care for our children. And sometimes the best way we do that is to relinquish them to someone who can save them.
Yeah, yeah. That's my thoughts, and that's what I've gained over the years from the various women that I've met, that who I've had the privilege of calling mom in some ways. And so I think in the very end, that's what would prevail, that unconditional motherly love, the yearning
right.
for the success for your child.
That's exactly right. Well stated.
Who should read Chicken Soup for the Soul, The Joy of Adoption?
Well, the great thing about this book is everybody who has an interest in affiliation with or even an interest in
mm-hmm.
Adoption. Sometimes people ask me, is this appropriate for my child who I adopted? And I said yes. And is it appropriate for somebody thinking about adoption? Absolutely. There's stories in there even about for grandparents of adopted
mm-hmm.
children, that, and the grandparents just love it because grandparents get as connected to adopted children as birth children, similar as moms and dads do. So we even have stories in there of people who relinquished their child. So we have stories in there for people who did relinquish, and they can relate to the stories specifically about that. And then when they
mm-hmm.
read these wonderful stories about the adoption kids, it brings them tremendous joy, as you just mentioned, because of that unconditional forever love.
Yeah.
And parents who are considering adoption get a lot of hope from it and excitement from it and encouragement. Grown children, it's amazing how many grown children, in you know, even your age, that
yeah.
I appreciate all of these stories. And so I very deliberately created it in a way that has stories from every perspective along the adoption spectrum.
Wonderful. Did you learn something special from reading all the amazing stories that people submitted?
You know, I learned something from every book, and I don't ever know what that's going to be. But at the end, I think, well, I learned this. And
uh-huh.
here's what I thought. Here's one big thing I learned. And that was, I thought when I walked into that room of 100 babies and Mitch took a look at me and crawled over to me and picked me, I thought that was a unique one in a million thing that would never possibly happen. And
mm-hmm.
it is just amazing to me that my whole theory, that God assigns a child, and don't worry, he'll connect you to it, how many adoptive parents had the same thing and felt the same thing. Mm-hmm. There are people mm-hmm. that walked into in Romania could walk into a building with 200 babies and look across the room and say, "Oh, no, that one right over there in the corner in the dark, and that's my baby." I could just tell it. Here's the thing about adoption. This story is not in the book. The family didn't, but this is a story mm-hmm. I heard years ago. A family chose not to write about it because they didn't think it was this unique. But they knew they were supposed to adopt, and they went online and they found an adoption agency, and they found a picture of a child online, and they knew at that moment that child was to be theirs. And they were in such a hurry. They knew that if they did not get their name in right now, they would lose mm-hmm. this opportunity, maybe. And so they were frantically trying to get the paperwork done and trying to get it all done because they had to have this child and everybody's going to want it. And they showed me the picture of a child, and it was a child with a grossly deformed face.
Mm-hmm.
And they knew everybody was going to want this child.
mm-hmm.
And the truth mm-hmm. is, nobody had. But they felt so, they knew that was their divinely assigned child. And they did bring the child. They adopted the child, brought to the United States, and had all this reconstructive surgery done, and the child is living happily ever after. Mm-hmm. But that just tells the story to make your point of that when you know that child is meant for you.
Right.
And created for.
Right. Wonderful. What would you like for the readers to gain from reading this wonderful book?
You know, we deliberately put one word in the title, and that is the joy.
Yeah.
The joy of adoption. To say it's easy, it's not.
Right.
But then neither is labor and delivery. it's not always easy. It's got its challenges, as does every type of a child coming into your life. And
mm-hmm.
But it is absolutely a phenomenal, wonderful, joyful experience and a life. It's not just an experience, it's a life. And I guess that would be the takeaway, that it, you know how the news always, you know, shares negative things, and too often people want to share negative stories. I used to joke, even when I was pregnant, even when I was teaching childbirth classes, everybody wants to tell you about their horrible, terrible labor.
Yeah.
And you know what I mean? And why everybody wants to share that with you. I thought, well, why would you want to tell me this? And sometimes around adoptions, you hear the hard stories.
Yeah.
And too often, I think we don't hear enough of, for every hard story, there are thousands of glorious, joyful ones.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what this book is about.
So true. I have selected several stories from the book as talking points for this morning. I'm going to go through them, and hopefully you can help me talk a little bit more about these individuals. The first one is actually, as you know, Chicken Soup have always broken up their books to about several sections. They do have 10 wonderful sections in this particular book. And the first one is Claiming My Own. The first story that I selected is titled The Hidden Blessing by Brenda Hand. This story is fascinating to me because it's about the mother who became an activist to adopt a child from Hungary, and after overcoming the governmental hostility and so forth, and she now runs a program in the United States. I believe you may have known this person or this story.
I did not know this person or this story before she sent it to me. Isn't it fabulous? Right. That's the great thing about my job.
This person, what's interesting about it is that she actually runs an adoption program right now that have placed over 1,600 children.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Because
so,
of her, but that was not her intention. And isn't that what's wonderful? Is that she went, you know, to Hungary to, you know, for her child.
Yeah.
And then, and that was another calling for her altogether. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The other story that I thought was fascinating in the same category of Claiming My Own is titled Roots by Dave Gordon.
Oh, him I do know.
Yes.
He is a friend of mine, and I begged him to write this story because he was, as the story shows, a foster father and had so many children come through their home, and yet he knew this one was the one they were to adopt.
what's fascinating about his story is the fact that they eventually, I think, move 100 miles away to legally adopt the two boys, if I'm not mistaken.
That's right. Isn't that interesting? Parents will do whatever it takes.
right. And that comes again to the power of that unconditional love that we talk about in the very beginning of the show.
Exactly right. And in David's story, I remember they made 3 trips to see the governor to appeal something when they said that he wouldn't be able to be adopted. I remember him writing, we moved out of state with our little saplings because it's all about roots and about family roots and where they would stay, where they would be able to adopt and this child and make him a part of their family.
Very interesting. What are some of the stories that hit you most with regards to this book?
Well, I have to be really honest and say, one that hit me the most is my own daughter's story of her adopting her child. And actually, she adopted 2. But it's interesting how many stories birth mothers, again, this motherly unconditional love thing, had almost premonitions about their children coming into their family. And with my own daughter, they had not been able to conceive it, but she, like me, had always thought, I want to adopt a child someday. So they were very eager to do so. And they'd had adoption not go through that they sort of had their hearts set on, but it wasn't meant to be. And she told me, as sad as she was about that, she said, you know, Mom, I'm going to have a baby this spring. Mm-hmm. by spring. And I said, well, honey, they said there's no more babies in the system right now. I didn't want you to be heartbroken. And then in January, she said, Mom, I'm going to share my birthday with a baby girl for the rest of my life. I just know it.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, okay. And on her birthday, on April 19th, the phone rang, and it was her adoption agency. And she said, oh, are you calling to tell me happy birthday? And they said, no, we didn't know it was your birthday. We have a baby girl. And she was born 2 days before. And to this day, for the past 8 years, my daughter has celebrated her birthday with this baby girl. And so when they had applied for adoption of a second child, and through this agency, they didn't know if it would be boy or girl or what it was. They didn't ever specify. And she did it again. One morning, she said, and again, she said to me, Mom, you know, I said I wanted a suitcase for Christmas. Well, I'm going to need it earlier. We're going to have a baby by Christmas. And I said, well, honey, this is September. We're going to have a baby by Christmas. And one November morning, she was off work, and she said, I just whispered out loud, you know, God, I'm off work today. This would be a perfect day for the phone call. And she and her little 3-year-old girl even got out the bassinet, and they got out a diaper bag, and they started to put things in a diaper bag, and the phone rang. And it was the adoption agency saying, you have a son. And there were more stories like that of the premonitions that mothers got of a child coming. Just tells you that it's all divinely guided somehow, isn't it?
Right. I'm totally fascinated with all the various stories. There's so many wonderful stories. One of the stories that got to me is in the section of Lessons of a Lifetime. The story's title is Do You Love Me As Much? By Nancy Liddell. The reason why I like this story is because this woman was adopted and always wondered, like me, if I was loved as much as a birth child. In her story, what's interesting is that the fact that now she's a mother, since then have adopted 2 children and then 2 children of her own that she has by birth. And now she truly experienced the joy of motherhood in the sense that it doesn't matter whether it's from my womb or not. Love is love.
That's exactly right. And she didn't get that when she would say to her mom, do you love me as much as you would love a real kid? That's what she said to her mother when she was 10. And, you know, what makes you think you're not real, Nancy? Well, you know, but she couldn't get that. And I think that's the thing. There's probably a lot of listeners now listening to me saying, you know, I can't relate to that a bit. That's pretty hard to, hard. And even Nancy, as an adopted child, couldn't get it until she adopted a child.
Right.
And so it's one of those things, I think, like motherhood and other things, and fatherhood even, that you can't really know until it happens to you. But, and as a matter of fact, that now that person has four boys now, she said, two adopted and two miracle birth children and two adopted child. And she says, too, it's the same thing.
When you talk about something like that, I think it's a natural. You and I mentioned about mother's fear is like, oh, my gosh, my adopted child is going to be running back to the birth mother. And then from the son's perspective or the child's perspective, with all this headache that I'm, quote unquote, facing with my parents, so to speak, maybe life would have been better with my birth mom or birth family, so to speak. And lo and behold, that's not necessarily the truth.
Oh, usually not. Almost always not. There was a very dire reason that that person relinquished a child. Mm-hmm. And it was always for the safety of the child. And and when you asked me earlier, in my opinion, I think people shouldn't seek their birth parents until they're of age. And what many families say to their teenagers who might just shout that out, I'm going to find my real mother.
Yeah,
when you're 18, you're certainly welcome to do that, and I'll support you. And very often at that age they don't want to anyway. The age that they often do when they are at a point in their life where they're having children.
Mm-hmm.
And when they are settling down or having their own children, that's when they start thinking about this whole roots thing. And and sometimes it's as late as that in their life before they want to explore it, if at all. And many don't at all.
Right. There's a story in the book that's fascinating under defining moments. The title of the story is Open Door Policy by Laura Christensen. This story brings to the forefront about how a couple maintains an open communication with her son's teenage birth mother. And this is interesting because nowadays people are more inclusive from that perspective.
That's right. Right in the country, in the United States today, open adoptions are encouraged. Mm-hmm. And that they have a philosophy about that. Is that it's better for the birth mother, some people think, and some think it's better for the birth child to have an ongoing relationship with their birth mother. Mm-hmm. Many adoption agencies actually insist on that. I'm being very honest. I'm not a big proponent of it. But I think that is another thing that's up to every individual family. I have a friend who's child is adopted and from Chicago, and they make a trip annually to go back to visit her birth mother. She's a part of their life. They sometimes people are very involved with them, as in this story, and the teenage mom actually comes to family parties and picnics and is a very important part, and in this child's case, a very, very important part of their family. So that's the open adoption approach, and it does work a lot for a lot of families. At the time when it was, it's been about probably 15 or 20 years that it's been a big movement in the United States for open adoption. And the thought was that it was going to have children who, as a teenager or as youngsters who go through that, why was I abandoned? Didn't they really love me? And that's a kind of a thing that adoption kids sometimes do experience, and they hoped that that would make them feel less abandoned. And I think perhaps it does. For some, it's just substituted a different question. Why was I abandoned? It is sort of like, how did I have two of you? And, but that's just my own opinion of it. I admit that.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is a difficult choice. I think in the end, you're right. I believe when you get to a certain age where the child has that independence of making an informed decision, I believe once given that opportunity, I think it's out of your hands in a way.
just that you said that it is out of your hands. And I would add one thing, and you have been a terrific mother, as you said. I think if a child ever decides to do that, the most important thing for the parents to do is support them in it. Never make them feel like you're not going to support them or that they have to make a choice or you can't love her and you can't love me and what I ever do. And if you really loved me, you wouldn't have to seek another mother. It's nothing like that. And
so
my advice to them is just to, you know, there is nothing you could do about it. They need to go find this and search this out. But the thing you should do about it is to be absolutely loving and supportive through it.
Yeah. Well, there's a completeness that comes to our life cycle on this earth. And so a lot of people are looking for that.
That's right. And as you know and point out so articulately, Johnny, and everybody has to find that path for themselves, that completeness path. And and we can't dictate it to another person.
Right, right. In a section called Gratitude, Chapter 9, I have a wonderful story here that I thought it's a little bit unique, and this rings true for me in the sense that from a perspective, I met so many people in my life that I consider who are my moms, my surrogate moms, so to speak. This story is Mrs. Usher by Roger Dean Kaiser in Chapter 9. The title is Gratitude in Chapter 9, and it's Mrs. Usher.
Right.
And this is an interesting story about a boy in juvenile reform school. Are you familiar with this story?
Of course, yes. I certainly am. It's a beautiful story, and that, and it's honestly, she did not adopt him,
right?
If I remember the story correctly, but she took care of him. She was, he went to her when he was in the reform school, and she cared for him and she loved him in a way that was exactly what he needed then. I mean, which just shows how many other people can be in your life that can be mother-like for you. And a lot of what she did was just sat down with him and offered him a Coke. And so much of the story began because she knew how to relate to this little 12-year-old boy. At one point in the story, I remember that she asked him that he was going to be, had to go back to the reform school.
Mm-hmm.
And he did not want to go back there. And, he heard her get very mad and say, "I'm not going to bring him back to that juvenile hall and be locked up again." And he said, "I love that woman for saying that." And she did. And she did. He stayed with her for several weeks and then ended up going out on his own later. But she was absolutely, he saw her off and on for the next 20 or 30 years until she passed, because that was such an important role model, and it was an important person in his life. So we never know, do we, how those women in our lives can impact us that way.
Well, when you talk about unconditional motherly love, it is a very potent love. And at the same time, one needs to understand, in order to receive love, you got to be open to receive love in this case. And then, of course, for the love to be reciprocated, one has to be able to give that kind of love. And in this particular case, this gentleman just needed that.
Right. And in the front, one wonderful fun thing about that was he didn't even know he had that capacity in him.
Mm-hmm.
And she drew that out of him. And isn't that the beautiful part of the story, is that capacity to love and to accept love and then to return it. And yeah, and there's a very beautiful ending to that story, as I recall, of him just sitting on quiet nights on a porch swing and that loved, he said, somebody who loved me when nobody else in the world would, you know, and he ends it with, "And I love you, Mom," because that's who she was to him. That's
precisely,
that's the lesson that she taught.
Wonderful.
And the wonderful thing is she didn't even know she was teaching it. I mean, she did not set out to say, "I'm going to teach this boy." You know, that's just what love does, doesn't it?
Well, it's the natural nurturing instinct from a motherly standpoint of view. And that makes a whole lot of difference. This is the irony of it, though, because I think sometimes the kids that are not necessarily adopted, and I say this respectfully, sometimes we take things for granted. For the ones that are adopted, there's a sense of appreciation because that's what you've been longing for, and you want that experience.
Right, exactly. And maybe they don't take it for granted as sunlight.
Right, We have a couple of last stories in the book that I really enjoy, and these are actually reflects back to Operation Baby Lift. The first one is Helping and Living Orphans by Betsy Tisdale, and I guess it's her adopted daughter, Twee Van Tisdale de Bliss.
Oh, Betty Tisdale and HALO, H-A-L-O, Helping and Loving Orphans, still is in operation today, and she's in her 80s. She's a phenomenal woman. You know, I went to Vietnam and was there for 5 days and brought a son back, and she went to Vietnam and went back and started supporting a whole orphanage there. And the last four stories in the book happen to be about Operation Baby Lift, and Betty's is the first one because she went to Vietnam to get her child, as I did, and she went back and supported an orphanage there for years and years. And during Operation Baby Lift, she was in the United States. She's a bank teller. And she heard about the Saigon was falling and Operation Baby Lift happening, and she found her own airplane and commandeered some plane, flew it, got the pilots to fly it over there herself to rescue the entire orphanage and bring those children to the United States. And the second story in that series at the end is by Burt Ballard, and he is one of the children that she brought out. And I will never forget, I went to an event one night 25 years after that, and Burt escorted her out onto the stage. And it was such a moving moment because he is very Amerasian, and she saved his life. And he has a fabulous family. Adoptive family, and now he and his wife have adopted children as well, so the legacy goes on.
How does it feel for you in terms of making connections and all these individuals back during the time of Operation Baby Lift?
Oh gosh, it's honestly unbelievable for me to see these young men and women grown up living happy and healthy and flourishing lives and giving back to the world, not just to their communities with their work, but some of them are just doing fabulous work throughout the world for causes and in their own communities and in their own families, which is probably the most important thing of all. It just gives me a sense of wonder and of great privilege. I often say I can't believe of all the people God could have picked to be a part of Operation Baby Lift that I got to be a part of that and to be at these anniversary celebrations to see these kids growing up today. It's one of the most fulfilling things that could ever happen.
That's fascinating. Where can someone go to get more information about you and keep up with your latest happenings?
Oh, you're so kind. I have a website. It's my name, LeannTheeman.com, LeannTheeman.com. And I'm a professional speaker now. Actually, I tell the story of Operation Baby Lift for a living and the life balance lessons I learned from it. And it's become my life's work.
Wonderful. By the way, we're coming close to the end of the hour. Since our show is about people, family, and living life, would you like to share a recipe for living with our listeners this morning?
Yes. My recipe for living is to care for your mind and body and spirit every day, all three, because we need all three to be whole. That's my first lesson. Too often we wait for weekends to sleep in late and go to church and eat a big breakfast. We need to care for ourselves, mind, body, and spirit every day. And the second big lesson I think is a great recipe for life is to truly live your priorities, not just give lip service to say that's my priority, but to look at your life and look at your calendar and make sure that you are devoting your time and your attention and your life to really living with and the what you determine to be the priorities of your life.
Very interesting. Leanne, thank you for the wonderful recipe for living and for spending this hour with me on From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. To all our listeners, please join me next Tuesday morning. My guest will be Elizabeth Sauter. She is an award-winning author, co-director, and co-owner of Communication Works. Since April is Autism Awareness Month, Elizabeth and I will be discussing her book, Make Social Learning Stick, How to Guide and Nurture Social Competence in Children. For additional information about this show and future shows, please go to fmmktalkradio.com. Thank you for listening and have a blessed week. Leanne, it has been a pleasure. Thank you again, and have a blessed day.
The joy has been mine. Thank you so much, Johnny.
Thank you. Bye-bye.